On a Monday, you're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We start with the outrage, the protests over the death of George Floyd and other instances of police brutality and state lawmaker responses. At around 10 last night, police deployed tear gas on the Capitol Square and officers in riot gear, along with Wisconsin National Guard troops mobilized. What questions do you have about the demonstrations, the pandemic, and how state authorities are responding? Have you filed for unemployment in Wisconsin since the pandemic? Are you receiving payments or still waiting? We're at 800-642-1234. We have Republican State Senator Patrick Teston on the line. He represents the 24th District in central Wisconsin, including Stevens Point and Wisconsin Rapids. He's vice chair of the Senate Republican Caucus. Senator Teston, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, before we turn to the backlog of unemployment claims, let's look at the protests over the weekend. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, what happened to George Floyd is an absolute travesty and an unfortunate example of police brutality. And I hope that the officer and officers involved are brought to justice. And I'm certainly encouraged by the peaceful demonstrations that we have seen, not only around the state, but around the country. But what's really unfortunate is when these have turned violent. And I think it's misdirected anger when people are taking their frustrations out on individuals who are not responsible. And it's really unfortunate to see. But again, I hope we can turn the page here and these officers can be brought to justice and we can honor George Floyd's memory in a peaceful manner.
How do you turn the page in Wisconsin? Do you see a need for greater oversight of police departments?
Well, I think by and large, the vast majority of our law enforcement officers do an incredible job. And oftentimes what happens in these types of circumstances, the good work that they do on a daily basis gets drawn out and forgotten. And so, in instances where they take their powers and their authority too far, there certainly needs to be accountability. And that's why we have a judicial system in place to do just that. And so I don't know if there's necessarily more oversight that needs to be happened. As you may be well aware, you know, I have worked on legislation with our law enforcement community and open records advocates to try and create more transparency and procedures as it relates to the use of body cameras that I'm still hopeful we can get done if the Senate comes back to take up the remainder of the legislation that's still out there. But, I think it's measures like that that can help move the ball down the field.
Well, in election years like this one, lawmakers typically don't meet as much in Madison and take floor votes. And now amid the pandemic, do you see more votes happening on body cams or anything anytime soon?
It's certainly possible. So as you remember, the Assembly wrapped up their regular session back in February, and the Senate was supposed to convene in early March. However, because of the pandemic, we weren't able to meet. As I've reiterated to my leadership, is that we need to be nimble and flexible moving forward if we have to take up more legislation as it relates to COVID-19. And in conversations I've had with the Senate Majority Leader, there's still roughly about 150 bills that are still sitting out there that the Assembly sent to us on their last day. And so at some point, I believe the Senate will come back. It's just a matter of when.
Just a matter of when. Do you see anything pressing right now as it relates to COVID-19 bills that you really want to get through?
Well, as you remember, back in April, we did pass a bipartisan bill, which had almost unanimous support in both houses, that helped us leverage the funds that were coming down from the CARES Act that was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Trump. Moving forward, I don't know if there's been many discussions as it relates to next steps, but again, we have to be flexible. I do believe we have to have conversations moving forward, and that's going to include having the administration come in and sit down with legislative leadership to talk about what needs to be done when it relates to K-12 education this fall, the UW system. What do we do if there are flare-ups this fall, if there's a second wave of COVID-19 outburst? And then also, what do we do for things like sporting events? Obviously, we have a number of sports teams here in the state, and are we going to allow packed stadiums or not? So those are some of the things that are still out there that need to get addressed. And I think moving forward, we have to be willing to work with the administration to develop some sort of strategy and some sort of ideas to put forward and as potential legislation.
We're talking with State Senator Patrick Teston from Stevens Point. You can join in. What questions do you have for him? Do you live in Rapids or Stevens Point, somewhere else in central Wisconsin? And what is on your mind? What questions do you have? What issues do you think state lawmakers should be addressing right now with the protests and amid the pandemic? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's look at unemployment claims. The state Senate's Labor Committee held a hearing last week where Department of Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman, he defended his agency's handling of unemployment claims.
While onboarding and interpreting new federal programs and instituting many policy changes, our existing staff's work in determining eligibility on 2+ million weekly claims in 8 weeks represents over 8 months of work in a normal schedule. With increased productivity and an influx of new adjudicators, we anticipate continued consistent reduction in our caseload.
So what are your concerns with how the state is handling unemployment claims?
I think there's a lot of frustration out there. I know my office, and I'm certainly not alone, I think just about every single legislator has received just a flood of phone calls and emails from constituents who are frustrated that they've had a hard time getting through to DWD. Now, I don't want to put all the criticism onto DWD Secretary Frostman, but in the lead up to this, when discussions were being had about the original Safer at Home order, they had to have known that there was going to be an influx of unemployment claims. And that should have been the time then to begin discussions to ramp up what needs to be done within the UI staff and the call centers. Because right now we have Wisconsinites who are waiting up to 10 weeks to receive their benefits. And for many Wisconsinites, this is an issue of whether or not they can pay their mortgage, their rent, whether or not they have enough money to put food on the table for their children and their families. And so a lot of frustration. And I know that, you know, there's been a number of reasons as to why this has been had, whether it's an outdated computer system. But quite frankly, we don't need excuses right now. We need results and action by the Department of Workforce Development.
Is there a bipartisan agreement on a need to upgrade the system that's been hampered by the outdated computer programming for a half century?
Well, I would kind of push back against that notion, because I know during that hearing that DWD Secretary Frostman and his deputy secretary talked about that it's an outdated system. However, these COBOL systems, and I don't profess to be a software engineer or an expert on this, but as I understand it, 90% of Fortune 500 companies use this very same software. In fact, 95% of ATMs use this software. And when you go to an ATM, you don't have to wait 10 weeks to get your withdrawal. And oftentimes, many people already use these systems on a daily basis. So, for instance, if you go online to book a flight or purchase items online, this is the exact same systems that are used over at DWD. And in fact, U.S. Bank uses the exact same system. And what's ironic about that is that that's the bank that we use to hand out unemployment claims.
Would you support authorizing more staff to reassign staff from other parts of state government?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this should have been done earlier on in the process. This is something where we have had a massive influx of calls into the department. And in fact, I know my office and many other offices in the legislature, we were passing constituents' contact information on to DWD for follow-up, and it's been frustrating. And so whatever needs to be done, it needs to happen sooner rather than later, because Wisconsinites cannot continue to wait.
Talking with Republican State Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point, in the midst of the pandemic, what issues do you think our state lawmakers should be working to address? We're at 800-642-1234. State Cap continues in a minute with Senator Patrick Teston here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we have State Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Teston chairs the Senate Health and Human Service Committee. He's vice chair of the Republican Caucus. What questions do you have for him and the state response to COVID-19? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Patrick is joining us from Richland County. Hi, Patrick.
Good morning, and another great program. Senator, I know of one rule you and the other Republicans made when you're in charge in Madison under Walker, which people had to wait an extra week to receive unemployment compensation. Now, how many other laws did you and the Republicans pass that you managed to make it that Wisconsin is the hardest state in the union to get unemployment compensation? And now you're blaming somebody else.
Patrick, I want to pause there for Senator Teston to respond to you.
Sure. As far as the one-week waiting period goes, I don't know why that was put in place back in, I believe, 2015. That was before my time. I believe if I had to take a shot in the dark, it was probably in response to the fact that for the last several years, one of the biggest problems that we faced in the state was not that we had high unemployment. It was that we had more jobs available than the workers to fill them. And so I think that was probably put in place as an incentive to get people back in the workforce sooner, just because there was such a high amount of jobs that were available. But in response to the pandemic, we took away that one week waiting period when we took up the legislation back in April. And so whether or not that's going to remain in effect remains to be seen. But I was very supportive of removing that 1 week waiting period, just because in these uncertain times, we need to be able to get people the resources that they need.
Patrick, thank you. Let's bring in Jim now in Appleton. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I personally think Wisconsin should take a whole different approach toward this COVID thing. We should be testing to see how many people have the antibiotic in them already, because my son went to Xavier High School, and they have 30 Chinese exchange students going to their high school. And during Christmas, I think two or three of them went back to China. And when they came back, we also host a student from China. And our student socialized with one of the kids that went to China. And right after that, our house got sick. I've never had a cold, and we had almost all the symptoms of COVID.
Jim,
more and more parents at that high school, and a lot of them had the same symptoms. So we should be, maybe it'd be a smart thing to go to that high school and test all the seniors that graduated and see if they have the antibodies in them.
Jim,
and the reason we should do that.
Jim, I want to pause there for Senator Teston here. And Jim is saying, you know, we need to change our tactics on testing, looking more closely at antibodies. What do you think of state testing right now across our state?
Yeah, Jim, you bring up a really good point there. And I do think the antibody test is certainly an avenue to pursue moving forward, because we don't really have a good idea as far as, you know, what percentage of the community has already come into contact with this. Now, I have talked to a number of different health professionals as the chair of the Senate Health Committee, and I've asked that very question. There's still some uncertainty about the validity of the antibody test, but they continue to develop that. And I do think that's going to be avenue that we need to pursue as we try and get a better grasp and handle on just what percentage of the population has already come into contact with this virus and who or who doesn't have the antibody. So it's a great point. I'm glad you brought it up.
And statewide, at least a third of people testing positive for the coronavirus are Hispanic or Latino. How troubled are you by the pandemic disproportionately affecting people of color?
There is no question that there are certain segments of our population that seem to be more susceptible. And that's why, by and large, I do think we need to be cautious. So just because the safer at home order is gone doesn't mean that the virus is gone. And as I've talked to constituents and business leaders and small business owners, it's that you have to be cautious. We have to take extra precautions when we're out in public, continue to social distance and do those things. And really, if you're more susceptible, then you have to take extra precautions to make sure that your health is being taken care of. And so that's kind of where things stand right now. And like I said, just because the extension order is gone doesn't mean the virus is gone. We still have to be vigilant.
Can you be vigilant without any type of statewide order?
I think we can. And I think by and large, the general public at large has responded to it. When you take a look at the number of businesses that still remain closed, I know a number of businesses have done soft opens. And by and large, people are going to be very cautious. Many people are comfortable with going to see friends and family, but they're very cautious about going into public where there may be large gatherings and masses of people. So I think people upon themselves are taking care of themselves.
We're discussing state politics, the pandemic, with State Senator Patrick Teston from Stevens Point on the line with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Rich now in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning. I mean to be respectful towards the senator, but what the people in common need to see is leadership working together. And I'm having a very difficult time following his argument, because when the Tony Evers administration came into office, into power, there was a great deal done by the people inside of this party not to expedite executive power and to work quickly with him. This was, I realize, prior to the emergence of COVID-19, but there was a great coordinated effort to slow down the decision-making processes which are ordinarily granted to executive decision-makers. And in Rhineland area, I'll tell you this, there was great confusion just over this HODAG Country Fest thing. First it was on again, then it was off again because the artists didn't want to subject themselves and their crowds to possible infection. We need to see leadership working together. And since most of the leadership in Wisconsin is with the Republican Party, that's what I'm looking for.
Senator Teston, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll be the first to admit that the relationship between the Republican-controlled legislature and the incoming Evers administration got off on a very rocky foot. And, you know, it hasn't been the strongest, it hasn't been the greatest, the back and forth and the dialogue between the legislature and the executive branch. And that's one thing that I continued to push my leadership on, is that we need to be able to build that bridge of communication. We need to be willing to extend the olive branch. Obviously, there are going to be differences of opinion and differences of governing philosophy between two different parties in divided government. But in times like these, where we're facing a pandemic that doesn't discriminate versus Democrat or Republican, conservative, liberal, and everything in between, we have to be willing to put our heads together and do what's best in the interest of the people we represent and to put our best foot forward and address the challenges of our time.
Governor Evers ordered state agencies to cut their spending by $70 million, more than half of the money coming from the UW system. So as a state looks to make more cuts in spending or services, where do you want to see those cuts made first?
You know, that's a really good question. And it's I hope that moving forward that we don't put the brunt of these cuts on the UW system, because I think we're going to have to rely on UW system moving forward for research and innovation as it relates to any potential vaccines, or as was mentioned earlier, the antibody tests and other things of that nature. So collectively, it's going to be really tough to forecast right now. As we take a look going into the next biennium, the next state budget, we don't really have a firm grasp on what our revenue numbers are going to look like, just because this pandemic has ravaged our economy. In fact, last month, the Badger Institute released a report that showed for every single day that we were in a partial shutdown, it was estimated that we lost roughly $180 million per day. So when you take that statewide, we're going to have to make some really tough decisions. And that's why we are going to have to make some hard choices. And that's why we're going to have to rely on our agency heads. We're going to have to rely on feedback from the UW system and, more importantly, the constituents of the state and the residents of the state on where we're going to allocate precious resources, because they are going to be significantly limited than where we were in this last biennium.
Senator Teston, we're nearing the end of the school year. Our state schools remain closed under state orders. Do you expect kids to return to classrooms this fall?
I hope so. And that's one of the reasons why I hope we can work with the Evers administration to develop a plan that we can open up our K-12 education system safely this fall, because I've got great concerns, even though a number of school districts have done a tremendous job with the virtual learning, but that doesn't work for every single student. And many students, they learn best when they're right there in the classroom. I know, for instance, in a number of areas within my district, for instance, like Wood County, all the school districts in Wood County have created a task force to work together and work on guidelines to open up this fall, but they're still asking for guidance from the state. And so I do think that's going to be one of the biggest issues that we need to address between now and next September.
Senator Tustin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Patrick Tustin is a Republican state senator who represents the 24th District in central Wisconsin, including Stevens Point and Wisconsin Rapids. Coming up, Democratic Representative Chris Taylor of Madison is here with her response to the protests in Madison over the weekend as dozens of businesses were looted. Did you go to a protest? How have you expressed your anger over the death of George Floyd? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Representative Taylor right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A quick programming note here. Join us tonight from 7 until 9 for a two-hour national call-in on race in America. Hosts Kai Wright and Brian Lehrer will convene a national conversation about racism and the election. It's America, Are We Ready? That's tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network. Right now, looking back at weekend protests, last night several hundred people marched up and down State Street in Madison and around the Capitol Square building chanting, Governor Evers called up the National Guard to assist local police. Representative Chris Taylor of Madison has worked on bills for years to address de-escalation tactics. What do you want to say about the riots across America and protests in your community? What is the relationship like with police in your city? Is it strained? We're at 800-642-1234. Representative Chris Taylor is a Democrat from Madison. Representative Taylor, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with your legislation you introduced earlier this year to regulate how police departments can use deadly force. What is this bill about?
Well, look, this bill is about accountability and transparency and getting better standards that the community wants, that policing organizations have sanctioned, that President Obama's task force on 21st century policing have recommended. So it's about getting clear, more definitive standards for when force can be used. I started looking at this issue after Tony Robinson, this issue specifically of when force is used by police, after Tony Robinson was killed in my district.
In 2015.
So I've been looking at this issue. In 2015. So I've been looking at this issue, even going back before that, I had another civilian death in 2012 in my district and started working on these issues really back then. But what I found, and I think this is good news, it's not going to solve, you know, my bills are not going to be an absolute panacea for centuries of abuse and brutality in policing directed against people of color and African Americans. But the good news that I found in doing this research is there really is a way to reduce the use of force to protect the public and also protect the police so they're not getting injured. So there are principles that have been adopted by police departments around this country and subsequently have been recommended by a lot of these professional, you know, national groups that have looked at the issue. And honestly, the very first thing that I started seeing in policies from departments that had been successful in reducing incidents of force, including incidents of lethal force, is one of the first things I kept seeing is this statement that the primary duty of all law enforcement is to preserve the life of all individuals. When I first started seeing this principle echoed in police policies, I didn't ascribe it a lot of weight. You know, I didn't really see it as being so important, but I began to see how important that affirmative statement was. And so that is one of the first recommendations. That sets the tone for police policy. That statement that the primary duty of law enforcement is to preserve the life of everyone, I begin to believe is very, very important to include in every single use of force policy. But things like that are so simple.
How much variance do you see from one police department to another on the use of force?
So, you know, a lot of, in fact, I would say the majority of police departments default to this very old U.S. Supreme Court case called Graham v. Connor, which set a standard that's called the objective reasonableness test in evaluating whether the use of force by law enforcement constituted a seizure under Fourth Amendment constitutional law. That does not really talk about that. That case was about a civil case. It doesn't really talk about criminal actions, but it's been adopted as kind of this default standard. And the real problem with it in evaluating whether the use of force was reasonable or not reasonable, the real problem with the standard is it's very vague, it's very amorphous, it's very broad. There is no reason that states and localities and city councils, for that matter, can't go above and beyond that objective reasonableness standard and actually put some actual concrete standards, like deadly force is to be used only as a last resort. I don't think I've ever talked to anybody who doesn't agree with that standard. And yet you don't see that articulated in a lot of use of force standards. The other thing that I kept seeing in policies of departments that have been successful is making sure that the force used is proportionate to the threat. So don't use more force than is needed if there is a threat to contain the threat. And requiring law enforcement officers to take actions to stop or prevent any unreasonable use of force by their colleagues. That's a duty that I also saw consistently in successful policies. But the vast majority of policies I looked at did not have these principles.
We're talking with State Representative Chris Taylor. She's a Democrat from Madison. We're looking at use of force policies and what de-escalation tactics would look like in her legislation over the years. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. How are you reflecting on the death of George Floyd now? Did you turn out at a protest? How did you express yourself? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie with thoughts on this. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I agree with most of what Ms. Taylor had to say. But I am pretty outraged because I do believe at the end of the day, we are good people. This is a good society. But yet one side of the aisle, the Democratic side, uses identity politics to push an agenda. They created a powder keg. They purchased it. They set it up. They put out a wick. And now, because of an incident that is universally condemned, it was lit. The left owns this. They own it. They own the looting. They own it. They need to stop with the identity politics. Ms. Taylor, will you commit to stop using identity politics to get elected?
Steve, I want to pause there for Representative Taylor to respond to you.
Well, I just really reject what was said by this caller. The issue of police being used by the state as a tool to enforce discrimination has historical roots and goes back centuries. Goes back to slavery, it goes back to the Black Codes, it goes back to Jim Crow. So it is an entrenched problem. I didn't create the problem. The caller didn't create the problem. It has been part of our history that we have to end. And so what I look at, I looked at the facts and I looked at the data and I looked at the research and I looked at the experts, what they were saying about how do you reduce these horrible incidents, these tragic incidents, these horrific incidents. And one of the things we can do is to establish very definitive guidelines for when force is used. For instance, in my bill, there's really five main guidelines here. I talked about a couple of them. Another guideline is to use other tactics besides force, like de-escalation. you know, most police officers don't get a lot of training on how to de-escalate situations. So that's a very important factor. In another bill, I provide funding for that training. So look, I'm looking at the facts. I'm looking at what has worked, what has been successful. That's what I'm interested in promoting.
In late 2016, the Madison Police Department adopted a policy on de-escalation, and the goal was to reduce the likelihood for the need to use force during an incident and to increase the likelihood of compliance. How have you seen that policy work over the years?
Well, I think it was a really good first step for the Madison Police Department. You know, what happened in Madison is after actually Tony Robinson's death, the city council allocated money to study the issue and to bring in the experts and establish an ad hoc committee that did fantastic work. The report that was put out, the final report of this ad hoc committee, was some of the best material that I read, honestly. It was really, really good. So Madison is on the right path. I think the issue now for Madison, a lot of the things in my bill were adopted in this report, and this report that was put out went way beyond. It's very, very comprehensive. The challenge now for Madison is how you're going to enforce it. And really, in what I've looked at, you need an independent enforcer. You cannot depend on the police to take these recommendations and enforce them. So really the conversation that needs to happen now is there's 177 recommendations. How is it going to be enforced? And so that's the challenge that Madison is facing. But Madison is on, I think, since these resources were allocated and this really intensive work went on, Madison is absolutely on the right path, and it does. De-escalation is a really important piece of it. But look, officers have to have an opportunity to practice it. It has to be part of their training.
Who in your mind would be an independent reviewer here? Who would be able to do that, responsively and without some type of influence?
Well, you look, cities have done this all over the country. We are actually kind of behind the curve in setting up more of an ombudsman or an independent auditor. There was a proposal adopted by the Madison City Council for an independent auditor. So who you want is you want somebody that's not connected to the police. That's totally independent, that's hired at the city council and mayoral level. So some communities have looked at a civilian review board that has that responsibility. Some communities have looked at more of an ombudsman that is a whole separate independent office that monitors not just our internal protocols being followed, but monitors complaints against the police.
We have Democratic Representative Chris Taylor of Madison on the line getting reaction from lawmakers to the rioting, the protests, and you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at next steps for lawmakers amid a national outcry against police brutality. Next door in Michigan, a new bill would increase law enforcement training, focusing on de-escalation techniques. How do you want Wisconsin lawmakers to respond? Do you have implicit bias training as part of your work? What have you learned through it? Still time to talk. We have Democratic Representative Chris Taylor of Madison, who stays with us. Let's take another call now. Alan is joining us from Wisconsin Dells this morning. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. It's kind of disturbing to see all the images. And what I have is just a couple of comments, I guess, to make. The images going on around the country. One of the things that's very encouraging, however, to me is the fact that I believe that police in almost every city, major city, and also in Madison, are exercising extreme restraint. Now, I've been a circuit judge here in Wisconsin for 14 years, and on Saturday I went down to the demonstration in support of the Black Lives Matter and the black community, and I didn't see any violence. I left before the violence or the looting really started. But when I say police are exercising restraint, they're restraining themselves from taking the advice of our president, unfortunately, about shooting looters and other things. Property crimes have never justified the killing of anybody in our history. And to suggest that is really outrageous in my mind. And I think that the police officers ought to be commended that in most instances they are exercising extreme restraint, and they would know, they do know, I think, that the killing of these demonstrators who are only trying to, you know, demonstrate their beliefs of what is wrong in the country would just ignite what's going on even beyond what we can even think now. I said initially when this killing occurred that there's going to be fires all over this country, and in fact, there are.
Alan, I want to pause there for Representative Taylor to jump in with a response.
Well, you know, last night here in Madison, we had a curfew at 9:30, and I agree with the caller to a certain extent. There was tear gas and other things used. I wasn't down there against, I think, young peaceful protesters. So that, I think, we have to be very careful of. But I will agree that, you know, look, Madison, and I think the state in general, the people of the state of Wisconsin know how to protest. We are experts at protesting, and we do it in a way that is peaceful, typically. But I think what you're seeing all around this country is a despondency and a desperation. How many times do Black Americans have to witness Black individuals being killed by law enforcement? And, you know, it is, as a white ally, as someone who does not experience that discrimination, I can only imagine the pain of watching that video. And that's not the first video. There's so many others. So, look, there's things that we can do. That's what my message is this morning. There are laws that can get passed. There are ways to address what is going on. And policymakers can't just, you know, disappear and not say anything about what's going on.
What is the status of your bill?
Well, unfortunately, this bill has not moved in the state legislature. Now we're out of session. But look, there always can be special sessions, extraordinary sessions called. The issue that I encountered with this bill was it really had intense opposition from law enforcement, even though I got these standards. A lot of these standards came right from training. But there's a real perception, and it's an erroneous perception, that if you put these standards down in a law, it somehow increases the liability that police departments risk. And my argument is to not have these standards increases liability. I mean, we've had the Madison Police Department in Madison pay out millions of dollars. I've had three people, civilians, killed in my district unarmed by the police. So to not address this issue is a liability. And this is a way to do it with research and evidence that it can work.
Are your colleagues talking about returning to a session in some format in the coming weeks?
Well, Democrats have been talking about it for a long time. First to address, you know, we have kind of these horrible things that are disproportionately impacting communities of color right now. We have COVID-19 going on, and we're seeing, you know, that in some communities go up. We're seeing this police brutality once again that is impacting communities of color. And so, yeah, we should be back into session. I've been saying for a long time we should have gone back in and addressed some of the remedies and allocate resources to fight COVID-19. That never happened. So absolutely we should be back in. People expect us to be working. People expect us to be proposing solutions. You know, as I said, my bills are not going to solve every problem, but they're a start. They're a step forward. I will say, too, after Paul Heenan was killed, he was the first civilian when I was elected in 2012. We were able to get a bill passed saying that the police cannot investigate their own officers in a criminal investigation when an officer has killed a civilian. That was actually the practice prior to our bill passing in 2013. Now you can't do that. You can't have colleagues investigating colleagues in a situation where a civilian is killed. So we have made some very small steps forward, but we need to do much more.
We're speaking with State Representative Chris Taylor of Madison on the State Capitol Report. Let's take another call now. Cole is joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Cole.
Hello. I had a question regarding the amount of training that our police officers go through right now for conflict resolution. I was reading over the weekend about how a number of other countries, and I think explicitly in the UK, they have several years worth of conflict training compared to what I believe is a standard of maybe only a couple of days of conflict resolution training in the United States. And I wonder if we need to push for a lot more of that, given what we've seen.
Excellent, excellent question. Absolutely. Absolutely, we do. The de-escalation and other tactics that are taught to avoid the use of force are not the center of training. I mean, out of, I think it's 760 hours of training, you know, on average, it's about 8 hours of de-escalation training. So I do have a bill that says part of law enforcement are required every 2 years to get additional training in certain areas. And right now it's very, very limited what is specified that they have to get training in. So I do have another bill that I introduced that does say conflict resolution, de-escalation have to be 8 hours of the training. And I give funds to do that, because that's another thing that I heard from police departments. They didn't have money to do this kind of training. So it's critical. It is absolutely critical, but we need to make sure resources are available so that it happens.
Representative, turning a little bit to you now before we end, you were elected to the Assembly in 2011. You've decided not to run for office in November. Why is that?
Well, I've been there for 10 years, and it's been such an honor representing this community. But it's time to move on. I'm, hit middle age, and there's other things I'd like to do in my career, but it has been an honor, an absolute privilege to represent my community. But, we'll see where it takes me. I will probably go back to my legal roots. I love working on civil rights issues. I love working on social justice issues, and I'm a trained attorney. And so hopefully I will continue to pursue those avenues as I move forward.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
State Representative Chris Taylor is a Democrat from Madison. We've been talking about her legislative push in recent years to change how police departments use deadly force. Just ahead, we have more conversation about the unrest in the capital city over the weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.